Here's the Sharp Packaging System, Inc. I've got a division of the time, and it's as follows. 10 minutes for Mr. Britton, representing Sharp Packaging. 15 minutes for Terry Johnson, representing Niebler et al. 30 minutes for Maureen McGinnity, representing Harold Lane. And 5 minutes for James Rear in rebuttal. Correct? All right. Mr. Britton.
May it please the court, my name is Larry Britton, and as the court just pointed out, I represent the appellants, defendants in this case, Paul and Virginia Scarberry and Sharp Packaging Company, Inc. I'm assuming that the court is well aware of the facts, and I'll go right to the issue at hand here. The big issue in this case is, did Judge Foster, the trial court judge, err in exercising her discretion in ordering Niebler Records over an attorney-client privilege objection? We believe that the court did. To come to this determination, there are two questions that have to be asked. First, does the attorney-client privilege exist? And second, does it fall within the crime fraud exception?
I'm sorry, I missed that. Could you repeat that, please?
Yes. The first question is, does the attorney-client privilege exist? And the second question would be, then does it fall within the narrow exception of crime fraud under the statute, under 905.03? To come to the first question, I think we must look at who is the client. Lane, in their briefs and their arguments all along, have followed a line of cases called Kirby versus Kirby, Delaware trial court cases, unpublished decisions, which indicate or establish a joint client, joint constituent rule. Although in their brief they indicate that it's an entity rule, we do not believe that they are properly applying the entity standard. The Kirby cases are clearly distinguishable here. First of all, they are unpublished lower court cases from Delaware. All of them rely on a Delaware statute that gives board members broad discretionary authority to obtain corporate records.
Counsel, in yes, this case, just how would the entity rule work? As I understand the entity rule, the entity is Sharp Packaging. That's your argument. That's except one thing just concerns me. How would Mr. Lane fit into the entity rule? Just exactly explain just what you mean by the entity.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, there's two privileges here. First is the Scarberry privilege, and I do not believe Lane's status on Sharp's board of directors has anything to do with that, and that attorney-client privilege exists. But with respect to the entity rule as it applies to Sharp's privilege, it's our position, Your Honor, that the corporation holds the privilege. The corporation is the entity. The corporation can assert the privilege. Under corporate law, the management and power of the corporation are the parties who can assert the privilege. We believe that under Jesse and under the Milroy case and the Weinberg case, it sets forth a proper procedure to follow on when that privilege can be asserted and when it cannot. And
So here the president and the secretary hired counsel, and according to the, at least what I've read, that was without knowledge of one of the board of directors and a key officer. So how does that fit into that?
First of all, Your Honor, I'm not sure that those facts are before the court based on a motion that was brought to strike certain evidence. I have no idea what facts were before the trial court because there were no findings and there was no record there. But it's our position that the management and power at the time the privilege is asserted controls whether or not to enact the privilege. And that's based on not when the documents were prepared or when the communication occurred, but as Milroy said, why did they want it? It's a fiduciary duty to insert the privilege or enact the privilege. If they want it for personal gain, for personal advancement that's adverse to the corporation, the privilege is properly inserted. And that's exactly what Mr. Lane wants here. He is not looking at the privilege here for purposes of assisting the corporation or for the benefit of the corporation, but rather for his own personal gain. We believe the Milroy rule, it gives a great deal of guidance as to when the privilege can be asserted. And we believe it applies in this case and it's absolute. Now the second question comes down to, whether or not this falls within the statutorily narrowly defined exception of crime fraud. And we do not believe it does in any manner or respect. The Court of Appeals in Dyson specifically set forth the procedures to follow in determining whether or not you can breach the sacred attorney-client privilege. And what they said is you must have an evidentiary hearing to prove a prima facie case as to crime or fraud.
Now, here clearly, and I don't mean to interrupt again, there was not an evidentiary hearing, but there were motions, and the court heard some kind of, won't say evidence, they were at least heard the story, the allegation from opposing counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was a motion in this case, but we do not believe that complies with the standard of Dyson and clearly should not be the standard to allow the invasion into attorney-client privilege. Dyson,
what,
in fact...
What records precisely are we talking about?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What records are we talking about?
Well, the subpoenas requested all billing statements of John Niebler and his law firm from when he began working for Sharp Packaging in 1984 through May 31st, actually the subpoena says indefinitely, but the trial court ordered through May 31st, 1999. All communication and all files from John Niebler from inception when he began working for Sharp, on all files he was working on for Sharp, not just on Lane matters. Again, it was unlimited, and again, the court ruled until May 31st, 1999. But it's our position at the motion, Justice Wilcox, that there was not a prima facie showing of evidence of crime or fraud. What the court specifically concluded, what Judge Foster said, was that she based it on the agreement, the allegations in the complaint, and, quote, limited other evidence, unquote, without saying what that other evidence was. And that's specifically what Dyson says you can't do. You need more than mere allegations to pierce this privilege to get to these documents. The attorney-client privilege is so sacred that you must establish a prima facie showing. And then Judge Foster did not review any of the documents in question. She did not make an in-camera inspection on those documents to determine, even if she felt that there was a prima facie case, what documents relate to the allegations of crime or fraud. None of that was done in this case, and we believe that it was improper. This is a case, Your Honors, of nothing more than an alleged breach of contract over a distribution of assets from a AAA account to the shareholders in the form of a dividend. Totally proper procedure under corporate law. This is not a case of crime. This is not a case of fraud, Your Honor. If it anything, it's a case of breach of contract. This court, under the economic loss doctrine cases and under McKinsey, have separated the difference between contract claims and tortious claims. This is a contract claim, if anything, and we don't believe there's any violation at all.
Now, Lane was a director when this dividend was declared?
Yes, Your Honor.
When the loan was made?
I'm sorry?
When the loan was made?
I don't believe so at that point, Your Honor.
Was he advised at a meeting about the dividend?
There was not a board meeting called with respect to the distribution of the dividends. However, they were ratified on March 2nd, 1999, in a subsequent ratification. And furthermore, in a closely held corporate...
There? Lane there in March?
No, he was not here.
Okay. So while he was a director, he got no notice. He didn't participate, right?
That's correct.
And it would affect him, right?
Your Honor, it would have had no effect on the outcome of it.
It wouldn't have had an effect on the outcome, but he was affected by this distribution.
He has any effect that would occur under the distribution, Your Honor, would be covered under his contract rights,
right,
under the dissolution provision.
Why doesn't that look like and smell like a fraud on him?
Your Honor, it's simply a breach of contract. This conduct was anticipated in the agreement that was in place between Sharp and Lane. In the anti-dilution provision, it indicated if for any reason he feels that the company value is diminished, he can ask for an adjustment. He could have asked for it. He had his SAR rights. He still has his SAR rights to pursue.
If he were still a director,
would you be able to, and that brought this lawsuit in, hypothetically, you'd have to change the facts a bit, but still brought the lawsuit, would you be able to assert attorney-client privilege against him in a discovery demand?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you can, because I think the management and power controls what the corporation, and the corporation holds the privilege. And when, and in fact, in the Milroy case and some of the other line of cases, that was in fact the case. And that's why you look to why you want the evidence, why you want the documentation versus when it was initiated.
How do you distinguish the Moore case?
The Moore case, I believe, is based on the Kirby line of cases. And I believe the Kirby line of cases deals with a joint client, joint constituent approach, which this court in Jesse has already said is not the law in the state of Wisconsin. And in fact, the majority of the cases in the country have said that the joint constituent, joint client approach is not the law. It is our position, Your Honor, that there are no facts to establish a prima facie case here, a prima facie case of clear and convincing evidence to allow them to invade the attorney-client privilege. For those reasons, Your Honor, we believe that a procedure should be set forth by this court establishing what the rules are when the attorney-client privilege exception is being challenged. And we believe that
that we should send this back for that hearing? In other words, if there's going to be, you're just saying that they missed Dyson and there has to be a hearing before you jump to the conclusion.
Your Honor, I'm saying twofold. First of all, I'm saying that we do have an attorney-client privilege here and it was properly asserted. And based on that, there is no substantial evidence to prove a prima facie case of crime or fraud, and the court must vacate Judge Foster's order, quash the subpoena, and then grant the protective order, and in the alternative to remand this matter for an evidentiary hearing for a prima facie showing of clear and convincing evidence, both at the hearing stage and at an in-camera inspection stage, before those documents are given to opposing counsel. I think my time's up, Your Honor. I think the procedure I just set forth is the necessary balance. Thank you.
Thank you. Johnson.
May it please the court. I have the privilege of appearing here on behalf of the intervening appellants, Mr. Niebler and his law firm. Those appellants intervened in this case because, as the longtime attorneys for the original defendants, Sharp Packaging and the sole stockholders of that corporation, Mr. and Mrs. Scarberry, some of the discovery was directed to the firm, and they clearly had an interest in asserting the privileges and making certain that their own privileges and rights were asserted. The ability of this court to understand this case fully on the record, which is properly before it, and the issues which this case raised has been enhanced tremendously by the letter of November 1, which Ms. McGinnity filed with the court, advising the court of what it probably already knew, but which was not a matter of record in this case, namely the Court of Appeals decision on the second appeal which has been filed, which decision is now before you on a petition for review, which has recently been filed. That's important because it enables this court for the first time to understand the full scenario of what is going on here on a record which is properly before it. The Court of Appeals decision fleshes this case out by establishing what's happened here. An attorney who represented with his law firm, himself personally and his law firm, a corporate client, and as often happens in these situations, the sole shareholders of this closely held corporation, for many years, was called upon by the executives of that company to assist them with a problem. The problem they had was an agreement they had with Mr. Lane. They sought counsel, they received advice, and whether one characterizes it as how to breach the contract and what the consequences of the breach would be, might be, should be, or whether it is simply a termination of the contract and what consequences that would have, in what one could do as the client to protect, to enhance one's legal position, protect oneself against Mr. Lane if there was litigation or dispute, is a classic problem all lawyers face. And I will tell you, until this case, I don't think anyone has ever suggested that when a lawyer advises those clients as to what their rights are and tells them, in essence, assuming the worst in this case, you can breach this contract. You can breach this contract, and here are the consequences. And if you want to deal with those consequences, here are some things you can do which will improve your position. No one until this case has ever suggested that that was anything except a breach of the contract, arguably, or more importantly, that the lawyer had done anything wrong. And more to the point, no one had ever suggested that when that happens, you can come into court, file a subpoena, the breadth of which is literally breathtaking. And I strongly urge you to look in the record at the subpoena that they served. The subpoena that said, basically, because we think you did something wrong, you have to turn over everything you have for years before these events and time afterward, as if there were no attorney-client privilege, as if there were no work product privilege, as if there was no restriction on what you can get from a lawyer representing another party, a lawyer from whom you, with whom you've had no contact. You didn't talk to him, he didn't lie to you, he didn't misrepresent things to you, you didn't even talk to him. And then you can go to court, and by referring to allegations and pleadings and introducing a scintilla of evidence, convince a court to issue an order that says, all that stuff's got to be introduced. But it doesn't stop there. As the November 1 letter says, you can then sue the lawyer and allege that you acted improperly by advising your client and you, in fact, conspired with the lawyer. And that's where this is all going, and it's important to understand that in order to resolve these issues, because that's the end result here. We are alleging a conspiracy between the client and the lawyer because the lawyer advised the client on the client's rights and the risks the client took under a contract Mr. Lane entered into, replete with specified remedies, and then we invented tort claims, discovery demands, and conspiracy allegations. The court can start to deal with that today. The court can start to deal with that today by, first of all, taking the issue that Mr. Britton raised, and that is, who's the client here? And all one has to do is go back to Jesse versus Danforth and understand that this court did in Jesse versus Danforth what was necessary. It created a theoretical construct of an attorney-client relationship because the realities of the situation meant you couldn't possibly function in that way as an attorney if you didn't. In Jesse versus Danforth, we said, you said, all lawyers will now do what we always did. We will play pretend. We will pretend that the client we're representing when we're forming a business entity is a client that doesn't exist. Because if we don't, no one can do that. Instead, what they will have to have is they'll have to hire 8 different lawyers, and they'll have a committee of lawyers, and as lawyers, we all know where the committee of lawyers goes. Nothing will ever get done. So you said the only practical solution to that is to say, in Wisconsin, we have an entity rule, and that lawyer represents the entity and no one else unless there's some other relationship established.
Well, here
before it exists.
Here, the people controlling that entity have their own personal interests, right?
Correct, because they are shareholders.
That's right. So, and you got Mr. Lane who has his own personal interests.
Correct.
Under the entity rule, what does that do to
Mr. Niebler?
Pardon me? What does that do, one, to Mr. Niebler, and what does it do to the majority sole shareholders who have control?
Well, first of all, there's no evidence before the court that suggests there's any conflict of interest between any attorney-client relationship he had with the Scarberries and any attorney-client relationship he had with the firm. If there was, that's a claim to be asserted by the corporation against Mr. Niebler, or perhaps by a stockholder in a derivative claim with the stockholders of the Scarberries. That's not an issue in this case. No one's ever suggested there was any conflict of interest between those two things. The correct way, I suggest, Chief Justice, to look at this is to think about something which is not so different than what we had here. If the officers of a corporation thought that a director who was an executive at the company was stealing from the company, are they allowed to consult counsel? Well, of course they are. If you adopt their rule, if Mr. Lane, hypothetically, was doing that, and he got wind of it, as in small corporations, these things tend to get bandied about, and he went to Mr. Niebler and said, Mr. Niebler, are you investigating me? Mr. Niebler would have to say, yes, because he couldn't assert a work product privilege, and he couldn't assert an attorney-client privilege. And if Mr. Lane then said, please turn over everything you have on me because I'd like to prepare a defense. If you believe them, he would have to say, boy, this is really bad. But I don't have any choice. Here it all is. Prepare your defense, start destroying evidence, do whatever you can protect yourself. Well, that's absurd. And it's absurd because it is clear under Jesse versus Danforth, and I don't understand the Delaware statute, I'll be honest with you. I simply don't understand it. That line of cases that comes from the Delaware statute makes no sense to me. But you don't have to decide that because we don't have a statute like that. What makes sense is saying the client, the corporation in this instance, has the right to talk privately with its lawyer and to control who, even who in the corporation, gets that information. And particularly whereas here the information is adverse to Mr. Lane, they are contemplating action which he says is decidedly adverse to him, we can withhold that from him because he's not the client, and it makes no sense to say he would be the client.
Counsel, let's say this lawsuit, we have to change the facts, but in the changed facts, that in the lawsuit that Mr. Scarberry is the plaintiff. Let's get rid of the people, the names of the people in this suit. Let's say there's a person who, what we refer to as a mother and father corporation. They started it, they ran it, they built it up from nothing. It's the husband and wife, typical, you know, closely held corporation, husband and wife that did everything. And now they bring in someone to be an officer that's going to help with their succession plan and take over the company as they get older. And you know. And now something goes awry, and it's the, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but the pop of the mom and pop entity that wants started a lawsuit, and now he wants information. He hired the lawyer and he went to school together. They've been friends for 20 years.
That poses no problem at all, Justice Bradley.
Why not?
They hold the stockholders meeting. They vote a new board of directors in. The board of directors fires the president. They install someone else's president. The board of directors, the stockholders, directs the president to get it from the attorney, and they turn it over to these stockholders. Because the client can waive this privilege anytime it wants. And they control the client. That's the difference.
What if the company now has gone to an ESOP, so he no longer has the you know, controlling shares? But again, he started it. And his buddy, general counsel, so he can't do the kind of scenario that you say.
Then he can't get it because there are disadvantages to him, to mom and pop, in your example, from forming the corporate entity. And one is that you formed a distinct legal entity which has its own legal interest, which under Jesse versus Danforth is the client in most of these situations, and they are then inhibited from getting that information. Now, if they were in fact the ones who dealt with the lawyer on the situation, if they've got a memory, they're really not in the same position as Mr. Lane because they can remember all this stuff. If they got written communications, they've got the communications. I suppose the corporation could sue them to get them.
So you're saying it's okay if they remember the documents and remember the information, and they can use that in a lawsuit, but if they can't remember all of the pages and all of the words, they can't get them.
Correct. Just as, for example, if Mr. Lane was present at a meeting and heard something, we can't cause him to erase that, but it doesn't mean the privilege is waived as to other things. It may be he...
Who asserts the privilege in that kind of a context?
The corporation, by whoever is authorized to act for the corporation. And no one has ever asserted here that the corporation hasn't properly asserted the privilege. I already have my 5-minute light on. Let me just point out a couple of last things, and I'll sit down. The first is, I think it is important for the court to examine the record in detail as to what was asked for, what the evidence that was properly before the trial court was, and what the trial court said in terms of its decision and order. I think it is literally breathtaking because the work product privilege seems to have disappeared, the attorney-client privilege seems to have disappeared, and it's all disappeared because of this vague allegation that there was a fraudulent conveyance. Now, if the drafters of the fraudulent conveyance statute had simply said voidable conveyance, which is what it really is, the fraudulent term is completely misleading, as we all learned in law school, would anyone be here seriously contending that even if this transfer of funds was voidable, that brought it within a statute which establishes a narrow public policy that says when lawyers are engaged in crimes or fraud, the privilege is voided? Or would anyone say that that would permit the trial court to broaden that out to things that have nothing to do with the voidable conveyance? I suggest that what the court should do is this. Number one, the discovery request is clearly overly broad. That's what started the whole problem. The first part of the order from the court should say that request is denied. The discovery request, the subpoena, the notice for production is quashed. And then you should instruct the trial court on what should be done. The court, under the prior decisions in this state, has to make a finding outside the pleadings of evidentiary proof that I think should be to the middle burden, because ultimately to prove a crime or fraud, that's what they have to prove, that there's a prima facie case, ignoring the privilege materials and ignoring mere allegations in the pleadings, with specific findings, and that then the court should be directed to make a narrow discovery grant that is consistent with whatever findings have been made. And the only time the court should look at, to some extent I disagree with Mr. Britton and his client, I don't think, in all due respect, judges have any more business looking at privileged documents than litigants do. They're privileged from you, too. When people want to take the Fifth Amendment, we don't say, oh, but it doesn't matter, the judge can ask them questions. They're privileged from everyone.
So how does the court know, then, whether you're validly asserting?
And I was just going to get to that. The exception, I think, is that when it ultimately comes down to the point where the court's ordered to produce something, we say we produced it, and there is some narrow set of documents, maybe one document, maybe 50 documents, that can only be resolved by the court looking at it. I agree. There's no alternative at that point. But that should be the last resort after the court said, produce these things, the parties have produced it, and then if the plaintiff thinks they haven't gotten what they should get, to then have the judge, frankly, take up the judge's valuable time and put my clients to the problem of exposing privileged materials to someone who later may be deciding important things in this case.
How do they know what they haven't got if they don't know what's there?
By ordering a privilege log. Simply have us identify.
By what?
A privilege log. Having the parties provide a listing that, for example, we are not producing Mr. Niebler's notes on a meeting that occurred on this date between these people. We're not producing this memo in the file relating to this meeting. And if they think that's something which falls within whatever the court has found falls within some exception to these privileges, they've made the showing under the work product doctrine that they can't get it somewhere else, all the things that seem to have just gone by the wayside here, then we produce it, the court can make a decision, and we can move ahead.
But did you do that?
No, because the court made it a blanket is probably unfair to Judge Foster, but a rather broad determination that broad categories of things were to be produced, period.
Well, what about, for example, billing?
Billing?
Billings.
Mm-hmm. Billings in many instances would not be subject to a privilege. In many instances, I just can go by mine. I've never seen Mr. Niebler's because, of course, the attorney-client privilege applies to me as well. I have no business looking at that material either. But many of my bills contain detailed descriptions of what communications were about when I met with a client, because some of my clients insist on getting that.
I thought that if there's a problem in terms of the liability of the lawyer, that the privilege may be...
That's if an assertion of malpractice is made by the client. He's not a client. He's never been our client. He has made claims against us. That doesn't waive their privilege. We can only use it to protect ourselves against clients who make allegations where we need to use the material to defend ourselves. We're rather hamstrung here.
Have you considered or did you redact any billings? Say, here they are. I mean, what good faith efforts have you made to do a release of documents that are obviously to you not privileged?
What was done is that we appealed, Your Honor, because we felt that was being asked.
Released nothing.
The materials have not been turned over. When the order was issued, a petition.
No materials ever have been released.
The situation can still be corrected and undone without disclosure that shouldn't be made. If we released it, you could we would be back in the same situation. We could get the documents back. They wouldn't forget what they saw.
You concede that there are documents that are not covered by the privilege.
Certainly. There are certainly, there are some documents in there that are not.
But you didn't release those either. You just blanket refused to release anything.
No, we objected to the broadness of the subpoenas because much of it is not relevant. For example, if you're asking me, does Mr. Kneedler have things in his file which are in some sense discoverable? Yes, I'll suggest to you almost all of those are available from the client, and a simple request for production directed to the client would get the same materials in all likelihood. They're available through lots of sources other than taking Mr. Kneedler's deposition.
Thank you, counsel. Kennedy, representing Mr. Lane.
Good morning. May it please the court. First of all, I'd like to disagree with the statement of the issue as proposed by both Mr. Britton and Mr. Johnson. The issue here isn't whether or not there's an attorney-client privilege. The issue here is whether, as the question certified by the Court of Appeals, when you have a situation where the person requesting the documents was entitled to them at some point, then is there a reason why they can't get those same documents after the termination of their employment and their status that would have entitled them to the documents? What we have here, Justice Abramson, I think your questions to Mr. Johnson were going to this. The real issue that these appellants put before the trial court was, is an attorney absolutely immune from producing documents, relevant documents in a lawsuit pursuant to a valid subpoena? And as you pointed out, Justice Abramson, they didn't do what the litigants did in many of the other cases that they rely upon, such as Borgwart, where the attorneys produced the documents that they acknowledged were non-privileged and then designated those that they felt were privileged and argued about those. What they did instead here was just assert, just because Kneedler's a lawyer, he does not have to produce a single document. And that sort of blanket assertion of privilege has been strongly disfavored in a number of the cases that we've cited, including the Seventh Circuit's decision in Holyfield, where the court said, you can't do that. What you need to do is produce the non-privileged documents, provide a privilege log that allows a consideration of whether or not the prerequisites to the assertion of privilege have been satisfied.
When you threw out your net for discovery, I noted that you went way back to, now I may be wrong, 1984, is that correct?
Your Honor, that's not correct.
Okay, was it 92 then?
1995.
Okay, so you wanted nothing prior to 1995.
That's correct, Justice Wilcox, and the significance of the 1995 date is that those were the dates of all of the agreements.
I meant 94.
Okay.
Those are the dates, what I'm sorry.
Those are the dates of the various agreements between the parties, and I think that it is very crucial to focus on the contractual rights that are present in this case, which distinguish this case from all of the ones that are relied upon by the appellants. In determining whether or not Judge Foster abused her discretion in determining that under the circumstances of this case, this particular plaintiff was entitled to discover the privileged documents, it's very important to look at Lane's status. This is not some garden variety employee who leaves employment and then tries to get all kinds of corporate documents. This is someone who had very specific and very strong contractual rights that put him on an equal level with the president of the company. As an example, he was an executive officer, undisputed. He was the executive vice president. Under his agreements, he was entitled to equal compensation with the president. Very important, he was entitled to veto and or select professional advisors, including legal counsel. And this is an important provision. This is paragraph 6E of the employment agreement. He had the right to discharge legal counsel who was not performing to his satisfaction, absolute discretion, even without Mr. Scarberry's agreement on that.
Also, can I just interrupt? I guess where I got that information was on Helen's brief, page 213. It was a dialogue, I think, with Attorney Horowitz. I'm going to quickly, but it said that Lane wanted through subpoenas all personal financial information of the Scarberries from 1992 to present. So that was the time when he started working.
Justice Wilcox, that reference in that brief is to a completely separate discovery motion and completely separate order. The subpoena at issue here is at Appellant's Appendix 210, and if you look at that, you'll see that those the requests go back to May of 1995, which is coincident with the date of the various employment and other contracts between Lane and the Scarberries and Sharp.
What precisely did you ask for, Ms. McGinnis?
We basically asked for three categories of documents, Your Honor, and I, if I may, I prefer to focus on what the trial court ordered as opposed to what we asked for. What the trial court ordered be produced is bills and billing records for the period of time that Lane was an officer, director, and employed and had the contractual rights to control and oversee legal counsel. So that would have been from the period of May 95 to May of 99 when his termination was effective. And then for the period starting January 1 of 98 until his termination, the end of May of 99, the court ordered production of privileged communications regarding plaintiff, regarding the $3.8 million distribution that we say was a fraudulent conveyance, regarding the loan that Mr. Niebler obtained for the company to finance the illegal distribution, and also documents regarding proposals to sell the company, which of course are directly relevant to the value of Mr. Lane's rights. And then the third category of documents that the trial court ordered produced were all non-privileged documents regarding the subjects that I just discussed. So essentially what the trial court did was to establish a boundary line. Privileged documents Mr. Lane could get for the period prior to May 31 of 99, and then non-privileged documents for that period as well as the period after.
And you're not objecting to that order. You're defending that order.
We are defending the order, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct.
The 1995 employment agreement, the renegotiated agreement, parties to that are who?
Lane, Sharp, and the two individual shareholders.
Now, if Mr. Niebler were hired by Sharp after that second employment agreement, then Sharp would have breached the agreement.
Are you suggesting Niebler was hired by Sharp without Mr. Lane's knowledge? Is that the scenario? Yes, Sharp would have breached the agreement.
All right. Now, does that mean that Sharp loses its attorney-client privilege with respect to its own breach?
Yes. And the reason I say that, Justice Prosser, is because under the terms of his employment agreement, regardless of whether or not Sharp breached the part of the agreement that says he gets to select, he still has the contractual right to monitor legal counsel's performance because he still has the contractual right to fire legal counsel. How could he possibly exercise that right if he doesn't even know what Niebler is doing?
Yeah, but we've already conceded that Sharp breached the contract.
Yeah, I would suggest, Justice Prosser, that there's two different contractual provisions here. One is who gets to select counsel, but regardless of whether they breach that, there is still an independent contractual right of Mr. Lane to, in his discretion, to fire legal counsel and to oversee them. And in fact, if you look at Mr. Niebler's own affidavits, he acknowledges that the supervision of legal counsel was under the control of Lane and that, in fact, Lane had the right to approve legal bills, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was, of course, here they were concealing the retention of Niebler, so it didn't come to his attention, the work that he was doing.
I'm not quite understanding the difference between breaching the employment agreement and breaching the other part of the agreement. It's double breach.
Well, it is a double breach, but I think that maybe I could address this a little differently. In my opinion, Sharp and the Scarberries, as the shareholders of Sharp, effectively gave away whatever right they felt they may have otherwise had to have confidential communications with corporate counsel. I don't concede that they had that right, but assume, arguendo, that they did. They contractually waived that right by putting Mr. Lane in an equal footing with the president of the company as to the selection and oversight and communications with counsel. So that's what's key here. They had no expectation of the ability to have confidential communications with corporate counsel, and there's no issue here that Mr. Niebler was acting as corporate counsel. His affidavits repeatedly say that he was representing both the Scarberries and Sharp. So, you know, putting this differently, Justice Prosser, what Mr. Lane bargained for in his contracts was procedural protections for his 25% interest in the company. There's no issue here. He was entitled to a 25% value of the company that was a fully vested right. Through the combination of his stock option agreement and his employment agreement and a stock transfer restriction agreement, the parties built in all kinds of protections to make sure that that right could not be taken away from him. He was guaranteed a position on the board of directors. The significance of that, of course, is that it's the board of directors that declares dividends. So if he's on the board and they're going to declare a dividend, it may well be true, as Mr. Johnson says, that he can't outvote the other directors, but what he can do is immediately exercise his stock option and thereby protect that he now has stock interest and they can't sell the company or take some other action without his consent. He has a contractual right to what we've referred to in our brief as quasi-shareholder rights, and we refer to that as such because the portion of the stock option agreement that we're referring to is titled Lane's Rights as a Shareholder, and that provision acknowledges he's not really a shareholder. It was more advantageous not to make him exercise his rights and suffer the tax consequences, but the parties, through their contract, gave him the same similar rights to a shareholder in that, again, the shareholders could not take action, corporate action by the shareholders, without notifying him. He had a right to notice of all shareholder meetings and consent actions. He had a right to participate in discussions. And then he had this additional right to control who is counseling the corporation. So in light of that, there was no reasonable expectation by the Scarberries that they could have private communications with the corporate counsel who Lane shared control over. There is a way, as the More Business Forms Court noted, just because applying this entity rule as we advocate here, and again, we're not saying that Niebler represented Lane personally. What we're saying is that under the entity rule, the corporation is represented by the managers, as our opponents concede, and those managers included Bud Lane, so that everybody who was the corporate manager or director, and we're basically talking about three people, had an equal responsibility and opportunity to make decisions based upon legal advice that affected the corporation. You can't give a lawyer can't go in and tell two board members something, but then not tell the other three board members, for example, when they all have to make the same decision, which in this case is the decision whether or not to declare a dividend. So this was a subject of board action, required board action. There's no issue, contrary to what Mr. Britton said, there's absolutely no dispute that, yes, Mr. Lane was still a director at the time the decisions were made to make the distribution and to fund the distribution. The checks were cut and delivered to the Scarberries on February 23rd of 1999. He was not notified of any termination of any position until May 2nd of 1999.
Suppose you were going to write this decision, and of course you have to write it not only for the facts here, but you're setting up principles that are applicable. How would you write it? What is the basis for writing to affirm the trial court?
I would affirm the trial court on the basis of what I believe was the trial court's primary reasoning, which had nothing at all to do with crime fraud exception. That was a secondary reason. What I believe the trial court found is that to answer the Court of Appeals certified question, you cannot assert attorney-client privilege against a former officer or director who's trying to obtain relevant documents and discovery to which that officer or director was previously entitled. Because again, when you look at what are the policy rationales for the attorney-client privilege, it's recognized that it is a hindrance to the truth, and so the attorney-client privilege must be narrowly confined. If somebody had the right to the documents when they were with the company, what difference does it make if they see them later?
Now, does Lane's right to these documents depend on this arrangement that they had? And as you notice, participation and control, who was counsel, or is it just that he's the director?
I think there are several factors that demonstrate his entitlement to the documents at the time he was there. And if I were writing the decision, I guess, Justice Abrams, that is what I would make as the threshold question is, was the person entitled to the documents when they were employed? If so, the flip side is, the reason there's no problem giving them the documents is because it's not a waiver of attorney-client privilege. We're not saying that documents aren't privileged. We're saying you can give privileged documents to a client, or in this case, the representative of a corporate entity client, without waiving the privilege.
I'm asking you, would any director, pick me off the street, and I'm the third director, no special deals for me, would I be entitled to all these documents?
Certainly you would be entitled to the documents, the key documents that we're asking, that go to the $3.8 million distribution and the loan that funded that distribution, because, and the way I get to there, Justice Abramson, is to say the decision to make a dividend, to declare a dividend, belongs to the board of directors. So all of the board members of the board who are responsible for that decision are entitled to any legal advice that was rendered to any other board of director member on that subject.
And that those documents have to be produced by whom? Here you've got two people to produce the documents. One is a corporation, and two, Mr. Kneedler.
Correct. And we would say they have to be produced by both, Your Honor. Again, the theory being it's no different than any other client.
Client, correct. So it doesn't matter. He has the right to these documents.
There is me. I thought your answer might be more narrow than that, that it's tailored to the individual facts here. But it isn't. Your response is it applies to any director with regard to this type of issue that is.
I think that both the findings that the trial court made and the way that the Court of Appeals certified the question is instructive, in that we're looking at what are the documents that are being requested, and are those documents of the type that the person was entitled to during their employment? And that determination may vary depending on the position of the person. But certainly all directors, regardless of whether they also have an employment contract, are entitled to equal access to any legal advice that was given to any other director on a matter that is subject to a director-level decision, such as declaration of dividends and the assumption of indebtedness.
But of course this case doesn't have to go that far, since you have this director has a very special arrangement.
This director does have a very special arrangement, and that is a point that Judge Foster particularly took into consideration, was the, I think she referred to, the contractual intermingling of the parties here, which did put Lane in a different position. And the significance of that, I think, is that if the court agrees that on the facts of this case that Mr. Lane was within what some of the other courts in other jurisdictions call the mantle of protection of the privilege, or under the cloak of the privilege during the time he was there, then that really ends the whole matter. You don't even have to get to the crime fraud exception, because the crime fraud exception only applies if what you're producing is privileged documents to somebody otherwise not entitled to get them. And that is a point I would like to make to distinguish the cases that were cited by the appellants. In the Weintraub case and the Milroy case, and I think it's Tale of the Pump case, each of those are waiver cases, and each of those deal with whether or not a privileged document can be given to a third party who was never under the cloak of privilege. The issue in those cases is who has the right to either assert or waive the privilege. We don't have that issue here. Nobody's trying to waive any privilege. This is merely a client in the form of a corporate representative who owns the privilege seeking documents from the attorney for the entity. So there's no issue here of waiver, and I would suggest that we don't need to get into the Weintraub cases at all.
During the time period, the January 1st, 98 through May 31st, 1999, is there any dispute as to who Niebler represented?
Niebler's affidavits say he represented the Scarberries and Sharp, and that his bills were directed to Sharp. So in terms of whom he was purporting to represent, I would say there's no dispute that the issue is the authority to represent. And frankly, that is the reason for the breadth of our document requests and the breadth of the documents that the court allowed. With respect to billing records, the reason why we have a fairly broad request for billing records is that one of Lane's claims is that by virtue of hiring Niebler, Sharp breached his employment agreement. We need to be able to understand if there are damages from that, which depends on our knowing what did Niebler do, did the corporation get value from that work that inured to Lane's benefit, in which case there would not be damages, or was Niebler billing Sharp for work that he was doing to undercut Lane's agreements, which would not benefit him, and there would be damages. So that particular part of it, the scope that relates to billing records and time records and showing what Niebler did, directly relates to what is a fairly unique breach of contract claim in this case that you probably wouldn't have in a lot of other cases. The other documents are much more narrow. We're not asking for every document relating to everything. What we're asking for are the documents that relate specifically to our fraudulent conveyance claims here.
Would you address the hypothetical that was raised about an attorney hired to represent a corporation for purposes of investigating wrongdoing by a board member?
That situation, Justice Sykes, was addressed in the Moore Business Forms case. And in that case, the court, after determining that the corporate director in that case, or the shareholder represented by a director on the board, was entitled to the attorney-client privilege document, said, this doesn't mean that a corporation can never arrange to get private communications or arrange for private communications, and it suggested two ways you could do it. One, you can do it through bargaining in your shareholder agreement. This shareholder agreement could have said, after guaranteeing Bud Lane a seat on the board of directors, it could have said, however, the company retains the right to have privileged communications with corporate counsel to which you will not be privy. It didn't. It really said quite the opposite. As part of the protection of his rights, it said he gets to control and determine in his discretion whether to continue to retain counsel. The second mechanism that the Moore Business Forms Court discussed, which I think is very realistic, is to have a special committee. By openly using corporate governance procedures, the board or the shareholders of Sharp could have said, we have a question about X, Y, or Z. We want to get private legal counsel on that, and they could retain separate counsel who would not be counsel for the corporation, but rather would be counsel for a special litigation committee, similar to what we have in the instances of shareholder derivative rights. And that's exactly what Moore Business Forms said you could do. The distinction is you can't do it behind the back of somebody who's got an equal participation right in the corporate decision making. Had they told Lane that they were going to take some position regarding his rights relative to the $3.8 million distribution, he could have protected his rights. He would have known what was going on. They could have debated whether he had a right or didn't have a right. But they didn't. What they did is they secreted the distribution. They did not utilize the required board mechanism to approve it for the very purpose of keeping him from knowing it, so he wouldn't exercise his rights and be protected. And that is really what constitutes the fraudulent conveyance here. I beg to differ with Mr. Johnson that we don't have evidence of fraud here. I think we have quite compelling evidence of fraud here, although that's not necessary, a necessary finding for purposes of what I think is the primary determination. But specifically, Section 242.04 has as one element or one of the factors that you look at in determining fraudulent intent is whether or not there was concealment of it. And that is a very key portion of facts here because it specifically deprived Mr. Lane of the contractual protections that he had bargained for.
What about work privilege, work product privilege?
The same analysis applies to work product privilege in our opinion. There is another element to that. When I say that, I mean for the period through May 31 of 99, and I believe it's the Gottlieb case that says the exact same analysis applies. A lawyer can't withhold work product from his own client, and in this case, as a corporate representative, Mr. Lane is a client in that capacity. But for the period after May 31 of 99, the point is that the trial court disallowed discovery. So we really don't have an issue, I don't believe, of work product. The appellants have taken a very, very broad approach on work product, and what they're saying is basically from the moment Bud Lane came into the purview of Sharp in 1992, Mr. Niebler smelled trouble, and therefore for 7 years he perceived this real and imminent threat of litigation, and so every single thing he did during a 7-year period of time is work product. Well, the case is really don't take quite such an expansive view of the work product privilege. It has to be more than an inchoate possibility. Again, I don't think we need to really reach that issue because even if it is work product, Lane gets it because, again, of his position as a corporate representative of the client. Just a brief point on crime fraud, and again, I don't believe the court needs to reach this, but just to address some of the points that have been made. I've heard a lot of different articulations of the burden of proof between Mr. Britton and Mr. Johnson. I think the Dyson case very clearly sets forth the burden of proof. It is not clear and convincing. It is not beyond a reasonable doubt. It is not the middle standard of proof. At the point of deciding whether or not the attorney-client privilege is forfeited, all that has to be shown is a prima facie case showing some foundation in fact that a crime or fraud has been committed and some foundation in fact that the lawyer's services were utilized to commit the fraud or the crime. And here, again, we have substantial evidence that the fraud, primarily the very contracts which gave Lane, feedback here, I apologize, gave Lane his 25% interest, undisputed that the shareholders, Mr. and Mrs. Scarberry, made a corporate distribution, a shareholder distribution, and that lowered the value of the company, thereby affecting his rights. They did it secretly. It meets all of the elements of a fraudulent conveyance, which just requires, first of all, that there be a creditor.
I don't think it's your fault, so just okay. Continue on.
The elements of a fraudulent conveyance are statutory. Your creditor, which allows you to have any kind of a claim, it doesn't matter that it's a contract claim. The M&I case we cited, for example, was a case that alleged a fraudulent conveyance as to a bank on a mortgage. Clearly, the mortgage is a contract, so just because the source of your right to a payment is contractual doesn't in any way affect your ability to sue for fraudulent conveyance. A claim is defined as any right to payment, whether it's mature or liquidated or not. He had a right, he had a vested right to a 25% interest in the company. There has to be a transfer, which is broadly defined here. There was clearly a transfer, and there has to be actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud. In addition to the secrecy, we have direct evidence of fraudulent intent through the documents that we've highlighted in our statement of facts. Mr. Niebler went to M&I Bank on behalf of Sharp to get the loan to finance what we believe was the illegal distribution, and he told M&I, it's in M&I's documents, the record that we have before the court, and he said the reason for the timing, the motivation for the timing, is that they wanted to do this distribution before Lane had exercised his rights to be a shareholder. He told the same thing to John Howard.
Counsel, do you think, based on this record that we have before us, that this should go back to the trial court or perhaps camera look at what records are really privileged here? Because when I read over, and I do apologize, I had my dates wrong, but I saw that it was from 95, that it seems that the court, there was a wide sweep here. Would you think that the court should look at these and do it in camera?
No, Justice Wilcox, and there's two reasons for that. One is, under the cases that are cited by the appellants, the reason that you conduct an in-camera review is to determine if something is privileged or not. If the court agrees with me on the first issue, which is it doesn't matter if it was privileged, Lane was entitled to it, there's no point to an in-camera review. He gets privileged stuff, so you don't have to decide if it's privileged or not. The second reason, even if you don't agree with me on the first issue, is that Sharp and Niebler really waived their opportunity for in-camera review by asserting a blanket claim of privilege and not doing what they were supposed to do, produce non-privileged documents and only argue about the privileged ones. Both the Ninth Circuit's decision in the In Re Grand Jury witness case and the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Holyfield case that are cited in our brief say you can't do that. And I think there's a good reason for that if we look at this particular case. This case was filed 2 years ago. We've got two appeals pending. The appeals on the discovery order have taken a lot of time. There's been a lot of delay. For the appellants to sit back, not produce a single document pursuant to the subpoena, take it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then have an opportunity to start over again, what I would foresee, Justice Wilcox, is a whole lot more time delay is further appeals if now they don't agree with whatever decisions the trial court has made on the basis of an in-camera review. And those authorities I cite really, in my view, stand for the proposition you don't get two kicks at the cat. If you want to stand on your blanket assertion, that's fine, but then it's thumbs up or thumbs down, and I think here it's clearly thumbs down on the facts of this case.
So, assuming that there was a privilege, are billing, detailed billing records covered by a privilege?
First of all, we do assume that there is privilege, Justice Abelson. And to answer your question, I think it depends on what the billing records say. And that's one of the reasons the cases that I cited required that there be an affirmative showing as to the basis for the privilege. At various points in the argument, it appears to me that the appellants are trying to shift the burden of proof. The appellants had the burden to prove that they were entitled to a protective order. So they had the burden to come forward and prove application of attorney-client privilege. They didn't do that. All they submitted was a conclusory affidavit from Mr. Niebler that said everything he's ever done is litigation-related and privileged. So to answer your question, the cases that we've cited in our brief, Justice Abramson, say the identity of the client, the amount of the fees, the number of hours billed, and the general nature of the legal services. For example, bond issue is one of the things Mr. Niebler said he worked on, are not privileged. If the statement in the billing record would reveal an attorney-client privileged confidential communication, then yes, that could be privileged.
So what would be expected of them, to submit the billing records redacted?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because again...
I understand that, but yes. Assuming that you weren't, your client was not entitled to...
Yes. I believe that's exactly the procedure that's required. If they're going to withhold a complete document, they need to disclose what they withheld and the basis for the privilege. If there's only a part of a document that is privileged, then yes, their burden to produce the non-privileged portion and to indicate that they've redacted a privileged communication.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Is it Ryer or Rear or neither of the above?
Just point
whatever you choose. For my choice, it's Ryer.
Okay.
And I'm Jim Ryer. I'm the attorney for Sharp, and I'm Mr. Rebuttal on this one. First of all, in response to a factual assertion that plaintiff's counsel has suggested concerning the documents which apparently, in her view, have not been produced, I will bring to the court's attention that, in fact, on page 9 of our brief, Sharp produced more than 4 file drawers of information, plus 24 boxes that were made available for inspection of these documents. 11,453 pages were bait-stamped and provided to Lane's attorneys. In addition, Sharp offered many more file cabinets of documents that Lane's attorneys had not inspected. Hundreds of hours were spent preparing, sorting, and locating documents in response to plaintiff's request for production. So much for the blanket denial. Secondly,
did you do anything on billings?
No, not on the billings. The order, I'll get to that right now.
Okay.
The order, which is signed by Judge Foster, requires that bills from the Niebler firm to Sharp and documents reflecting confidential communications between the Niebler firm and defendants shall be produced for the period through May 31, 1999. It's noteworthy in that particular order there is no starting point. There is an end point of May 31, 1999. But the problem here is that the billing records, and I think, as Chief Justice referred to it earlier in her inquiry with plaintiff's counsel, is really an important issue here. They are privileged documents according to the attorney who prepared them and indicated in an affidavit, uncontradicted, that it contained narrative information which is confidential. And that narrative information, which is confidential, presents, as Judge Foster actually alluded to at the hearing, this could send shockwaves to the legal community when the lawyers' billing statements that are encouraged by virtue of our practice of law to be communicative devices with our clients, so we keep a good level of communication with them, to put narrative entries to say, what did I do on day one? What did you expect me to do? This is what you're paying for.
If I could interrupt counsel for a moment, though, as I understand the plaintiff's argument, though, the plaintiff is not saying that these documents are not privileged. The plaintiff is saying that the privilege cannot be asserted. It may be able to be asserted against an outsider, but it cannot be asserted against an insider with right of access.
Well, that's the point of the entity rule, is the corporation owns that privilege. The corporation does. And as a former director, a former employee, sues the corporation for personal gain, under the entity rule, it is the position in the corporation that attaches to the privilege. It is not the person.
Could the privilege have been asserted against him while he was still an officer and director?
Depending on whether or not those interests are adverse to the corporation, it depends on whether or not the corporation is acting through a specific bylaw condition as to what they will privilege that information to whom. In this case, Lane was not a shareholder. He was not a shareholder. Never was. And the concept of quasi-shareholdership is like quasi-pregnancy. I've never heard such a term of art that has been adopted by this court as a quasi-shareholder. It just doesn't go. Either you are or you're not. He was not.
Mr. Ryan.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Let's assume a little bit different factual situation. Let's put Lane out of this completely. He's never even worked for the corporation. He doesn't exist. So Sharp Corporation was simply Sharp, owned by Mr. and Mrs. Scarberry. And after 1998 or whatever, unfortunately, they go into divorce proceedings. Niebler continues to represent Sharp. Mrs. Scarberry wants access to the billing records of Niebler's representation during the period that they weren't going through the divorce, during the period they were married. Is she entitled to them?
Well, first of all, it's the corporation that these two people are part of that controls that decision. And the corporation at that time was composed of these two individuals. as you described this scenario. And the corporation at that time, again, is for the benefit of the corporation that that would be discoverable or privileged. If her action is against the corporation in the form of making those demands, they are not available to her.
Mr. Ryer.
For the corporate benefit purpose.
Mr. Ryer, what is the corporate's interest at all between Lane and Scarberry? There's no way, what's the interest? Or let's take the divorce situation that Justice Ballard posed. Now, the husband and wife may have different interests as to evaluation or their purposes, right?
Yes.
One may want it high, one may want it low, depending on the husband's going to get everything, he may want it high, otherwise they're low. What's the corporate interest as to which one gets the stock in the divorce?
Well, who's running the corporation?
Well.
That's definitely an interest. Who is managing the corporation? Whose corporate interests are at stake here?
I mean, you know, the corporation's a piece of paper.
The corporation is an entity that has to...
That's a fiction. Where is it? I don't see General Motors. General Motors is made up of shareholders, and it's made up of directors and employees and officers. And they all have varied interests. So what's the interest of the corporation? I mean, I think that's really the point of Justice Babbitt's question. If not, it's my point. The shareholders, I don't see what the... corporation has as an interest between the Lanes and the other shareholders.
Because it you know,
corporation continues.
The corporation continues, and the privilege goes to the positions that were part of the corporation at the time those persons filled those positions. It's not the person, it's the position.
Well, then your answer to Justice Sykes is that at the time that Lane was a director, he had the opportunity to view privileged corporate documents.
Depending on whether or not his interests are consistent with the corporate's good.
No, if they're that's where I got to where the corporation has no interest in the fight. I mean, I don't know if it does or doesn't. I'm asking you to tell me what the corporation's interest in the dispute here.
Well, it relates to the exact documents that are subject to this discovery, the bills, and all, as it says here, confidential communication between the Niebler firm and the defendants.
We're looking, I think, at the order of Judge Foster at pages 255, et cetera, in the appellant's Niebler's brief, right?
Right.
I just want to make, before I let you sit down, counsel, she ordered, the judge ordered mediation. Was mediation held? Just answer yes or no.
Yes.
Thank you.
If I could follow up.
Justice Sykes.
On the same point, as I understand your position, Lane, while he was an officer and director of the corporation, was entitled to access to attorney-client privilege documents unless his interests were adverse to the corporation. Is that a correct statement of your position?
Well, theoretically, yes, so long as it wasn't adverse to the corporation and he made a demand and those conditions of his position as a more member of the board of directors provided for that. He was not a shareholder. If he was asking it as a shareholder, he couldn't do it.
Right, but...
Under the agreement, he could not do it.
I think I understand that position, and this follows up on the Chief's question. What is adverse as between Lane and the corporation when what he is trying to do is preserve the highest value of the corporation as against the almost $4 million distribution that was...
Well, that's quite a jump because he is suing the corporation.
I understand now. I'm talking about his position while he's still there. There's no lawsuit, and whether or not his interests at that point are adverse, such that the privilege could be asserted against him as an officer and director.
Well, depending on the facts and circumstances surrounding, for example, the You mentioned $3.8 million. That's a corporate decision that is maintained by those shareholders who are the beneficiaries. He could not benefit by that, but only shareholders. If the corporation makes that decision through the majority board of directors, which was Mr. and Mrs. Scarberry, then it's a contractual issue that Mr. Lane may have a beef about, and he can have a remedy under the contract, but not to discover billing records and privileged communications.
So your position is if he was still employed and went to Niebler saying, you know, I think you're trying to undercut the corporation by issuing a distribution of $3.9 million without running it through the board of directors, give me the documents. Your position is that Niebler and the Scarberries, on behalf of Sharp, could assert the privilege against him and say no.
Well, yes. Then, if you'll notice, in his position under the contract, if he had a question or there was some concern regarding, for example, Niebler providing the services, he could veto it, or he could express his views on a board of director decision. He had, under the contract, a right to express his views, but he could not control the decision. And if the Scarberries decided it was in the best interest of the corporation not to provide it, that's their decision.
I thought he had the authority to fire counsel.
He had an authority to veto. It was called veto power, I think the suggestion was, to any vendor to provide services such as Mr. Niebler. Whether or not that veto power was exercised, I don't believe is on the record before this court.
Well, no, because he didn't know what was going on.
Well, under one interpretation, the other is he was the supervisor of all the records, billing statements that came in. That was his department. He supervised the person who reviewed them. So whether or not he actually saw them or not, we can't say from this record, but he was in a position where he would have been accessed to those records. Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I thought the record was that Lane exercised the veto rights over Niebler. That's what I understood the record to be. And indeed, as of, after 1995, when he renegotiated, he exercised that. I thought that's kind of why we're here today.
I believe there was an allegation at the lower court level by counsel that that's what happened. I'm not convinced there was an affidavit on behalf of Lane stating that fact. That was raised by counsel for Sharp at the hearing before Judge Foster.
Let me ask, does the record reflect that in 1995, Sharp hired new counsel with Niebler continuing to serve as the Scarberry's personal attorney? Does the record reflect that?
The record reflects on March 3rd, 1995. Is that what you said?
I didn't give the date, no. I said...
After March 3rd,
renegotiated.
Yes, in fact, that Mr. Niebler's affidavit in support of the motion identifies that. Yes. We don't dispute that.
Then I'm a little perplexed. The affidavit identifies that Sharp hired new counsel and Niebler continued as the personal counsel.
Sharp hired new counsel, corporate counsel, and that counsel was involved in the drafting of the agreements related to Mr. Lane in his employment with Sharp.
You're just saying we can't make, although the record reflects they hired new counsel, we can't make the jump that a veto was exercised by Lane because it's not in the record? Is that your position?
The record that's set at this point, no. It's an allegation by plaintiff's counsel. But that was raised by Mr. Horowitz on behalf of Sharp at the hearing before Judge Foster. And one of the final things I should say, and I'm all red here, and I'm out of here, what I would like to say is that one of the big concerns on behalf of clients and Sharp in particular is not only the expectations that clients have with as a member of the public to have attorneys' confidence to be protected. And, of course, that's what the state bar is trying to promote, positive images of the attorneys now, and that's important, is that the expectation and reliance upon that expectation is really a cornerstone of our argument here. And finally, Judge Foster's findings
like the smell test, sinister motives, without any specific facts to support those particular findings are very disturbing to us, and that's why we're here. Thank you.
Please be seated. Before I close this hearing, I want to introduce the Belleville High School students who entered the courtroom shortly after this argument started. The Belleville High School students.